It's Slate Night, the film fan podcast. Now, here are your hosts, Corey and Mason.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Slate Night, the film fan podcast, the podcast made by film fans for film fans. As always, I'm one of your hosts, Mason Schmidt. Here's my best bud, Corey Knudsen.
Ew.
And we're going to talk about movies, new releases, what we have coming up, film news, as well as a little bit of a physical media roundup. But we're going to mostly jump in and dive into the brink of the episode, or the brunt and the fat part of the episode, the juicy meat, which is us just talking about everything we watched from the previous week, which typically takes like a fucking hour. But before we get to that, Corey, how have you been? It's been about a week. What are we going to be drinking today? As it is kind of a quasi-celebration of us recording for a year.
Yeah, well, we are drinking one of our favorites, Captain's Patch, from Elm Creek Brewing, which we had about a year ago at this time, I think. So, drinking not only to commemorate 50 years of the Edmund Fitzgerald sinking, that's tomorrow.
Wow, we really synced up. That's great.
Yeah. Pun intended?
Yeah. Oh, no.
Wow, that was good.
That's bad. And Captain's Patch. That's great.
Wow,
we
something.
Did this. We did really well on this.
Yeah, yesterday I was just driving to work and wrecking the gold. What the fuck was that?
It's like a car just blew.
Holy shit. What in the fuck? That's Minneapolis for you guys.
You talking with you or doing anything with you is like that meme of like when my girlfriend's talking to me, but then a helicopter's going over it, and it's just private from Matt Penguins in Madagascar just fucking.
A lot. I don't know if the cameras picked that up. I'm sure it did. Anyways, yeah, I was driving to work yesterday, and The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald by Gordon Lightfoot came on.
Great.
I was like, wow, perfect timing. Tomorrow's the 50-year anniversary. You know, I lived in Duluth for a while, so that's a big thing. So not only that commemoration, but also, yeah, it's been a year since we started this. I think it was actually on, like, Tuesday or Wednesday, I think, was the official 1 year of our first episode.
Yeah. Whatever a year past election night
Election night was the first time that we recorded, and, it's been a fun year, man. I've had a really good time, something to look forward to every week, so.
Yeah, this is usually the highlight of my week.
Absolutely, yeah, it's fun, and I want to thank you for just all the time put into this. It's been a lot of fun.
I mean, you do more on the back end. He does all the editing. I make a thumbnail, which takes me maybe an hour or two long than it actually should, and then I post reviews. But it's a good way for us to have to kind of log our movie watching and record it. So if no one else watches this podcast or listens to us talk, at least in a couple years from now or a long time down the line, I can listen back to this and be like, God, Corey sounds like a fucking idiot.
Man, it's fun. It's a fun little piece of history for us for sure. I want to thank everybody for watching or listening or whatever.
All 27 subscribers of you.
Yeah, pass it along if you feel like you know somebody that would like it. Also want to give a shout out to my coworker Dylan, who helped us film our first episode.
Yeah.
It was really kind of a big turning point for us in terms of like getting cameras and lights and all that stuff. I know he listens sometimes, so Dylan, thank you for that.
We've slowly since tried to replicate how good that first recording went, which it never goes well, but we've since every week goes by where I'm like, Corey, we should get more lights. And I think if we add more lights to this fucking apartment, we're going to light something on fire.
Yeah.
So this is just the way it's going to look for a while.
Yeah, but fun a year in the books, so here's to another year. Cheers with some Captain's Patch, and cheers to the Edmund Fitzgerald. Pour one out for the boys.
Crickets. Just for those listening, us just swallowing.
That was for all. That was for all the men in the bottom of Lake Superior.
Oh,
right now.
Damn. Yeah. Yeah.
God damn. Gales in November, man. It's tough. All right. Anyway, so we watched some movies this week.
A year, and we're still not good at this.
Yeah. They actually made a movie named after Mason. Predator. Badlands came out this week.
Yeah, everybody, my stomping grounds.
Everybody calls you Badlands. Anyways, yeah, so we had a new Predator movie come out. This is, the seventh movie in the Predator franchise, not counting the AVP. Oh, Jonathan Taylor, long touchdown.
Yeah, we have football.
Let's go.
It's a Sunday, we're recording. Crammed through a recording of this, which usually takes us about an hour and a half. But the Vikings play at noon, and hopefully they don't get thrashed by the Ravens, and I'm rooting for our boy JJ. But also Indianapolis is playing.
Nice.
I'm a big fan of the Colts this season just because they're winning, and I want them to do well. Mostly Daniel Jones, but Jonathan Taylor is fucking nasty.
Fuck yeah. All right, sweet. So we'll get into the
actual movies.
Yeah, I've gotten distracted a lot already. Okay, so Predator Badlands, the seventh Predator movie, not counting the AVP films. The second one this year after Killer of Killers and Dan Trachtenberg. This is his third one, including Prey. And this one is about a young predator who is kind of a runt. He's the runt of the litter, runt of the clan on the predator homeworld. And he's trying to prove himself by going out and taking down this big creature, this big beast, bring it back, show it to his father, trying to prove himself to the clan. And along the way, he meets Elle Fanning, who's a synthetic from the Weyland-Yutani Corporation. Weyland-Yutani, obviously, is the corporation from the Alien movies. So they have a presence in this movie as well. A lot of big action, a lot of spectacle in this movie, lots of VFX. It's a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed this movie. Mason, what were your thoughts on Predator Badlands?
Yeah, I was relatively excited about this. I've heard like many great things going into it, and I've liked this recent run with Trachtenberg of Prey, Killer of Killers, and now Badlands. Going into it, it was interesting to get a shifting perspective of where the Predator is the protagonist and we're on their side. And also, not only that, they do a lot to humanize and kind of make us sympathetic towards this Predator as he's just trying to, one, get revenge, one, gain honor for himself so he can be like a viable, like actual accepted part of his clan. And two, like three, it's just a hunting story. Like, yes, you still have Predator elements because a hunt is somewhat happening. He's going out to try and take down his target. And I think that they do interesting stuff with the hunt and what the target actually is. And then you got Weyland-Yutani thrown into the mix. So the movie kind of juggles a couple of different aspects for me. It doesn't always 100% land, but I thought that this was a very fun outing in the Predator universe that is different from what we've seen before. I don't prefer it to the other Trachtenberg works, but I still do think that this is a solid piece of like action alien entertainment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that something Dan Trachtenberg has a good feel on is giving us something new with each installment he's done, which I appreciate a lot. With this one, like you mentioned, the Predator being the main character.
Yeah.
He's not the person hunting humans or whoever else in this movie. And I think that works well enough. I think, like, humanizing these creatures or monsters, it's, like, happened twice this year with Alien Earth a little bit, too. With the xenomorphs, where they kind of do it. I think it works a lot better here. Because the Predator is, like, a bit more human-like, and I think that kind of just plays into it. But I love, like, the worlds that we've got in this movie, the creature design, like, all the weapons and just technology that they had was cool. I like that they created this Yautja language for the movie.
Yeah.
And they had the same dude that did the Na'vi language for the Avatar films, so it's kind of just a very interesting, like, feels lived in as far as, like, all the Predator clans and stuff like that. So I had a good time with it. It's entertaining. Where the movie didn't work for me is that it starts to, I think it's a good movie, but not a great Predator movie.
Yeah.
Where, like, going back to the first Predator, which is my favorite action movie of all time, like, the Predator is just brutal and just spines are coming out every other second. And in this movie, there's no humans in there, so it's all
the
just synthetic
creatures. Violence is a little bit more muted, I guess, because it doesn't have that human core of someone just getting split in half.
Right, and that's kind of what I appreciate about the Predator movies, is just that brutality. And while I liked humanizing the Predator to a certain extent, it didn't feel like it fit within the franchise for me personally. Mm-hmm. And it also got a little bit too, like, I don't know, franchise-y, or started to feel a bit too quippy and like MCU a little bit. And I think a part of that could be with Disney now owning the Predator and Alien franchises. Like, that could be, they're like, we want to make it more accessible and mainstream and like have a cute little side character named Bud, this monkey that's running around.
Which, when I saw the movie, I was like, Corey. Corey's going to love this, and also this little guy reminds me of Corey.
And then you have the Elle Fanning's character, the synthetic, and like she's cracking jokes all the time. They're sitting on a campfire cracking jokes. I'm like, Predator movie right now? Like, I don't know. It doesn't, like, I'm not disliking what the movie's giving me, but for the franchise it's in, it didn't quite work. I don't know. I like a bit more of a serious tone with my Predator films. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. The other thing that I was going to say is that Weyland-Yutani, like I mentioned, is a part of the movie. I don't think they really needed to be in this movie, aside from like the one synthetic, maybe to have like a human sounding voice, or like speaking English. But I liked when this movie was focused on a predator trying to hunt this creature down and prove himself to his clan. And then it starts to get into Weyland-Yutani and focusing on them trying to capture these things like they do with the xenomorphs and every other thing we've seen. And it kind of becomes about them doing that, and it loses the hunt part of it, and then Bud and the synthetic Thea, they're all kind of teaming up and doing this little thing, and it just kind of lost what I liked about the initial, like, 20 to 30 minutes.
Yeah, I think it is not like a tale of two halves, but there's a point when Deck, the Predator, finds his prey, his hunt, tries to kill it, and then there's a little bit of a twist. And once that, like, instance happens, once that climactic moment happens within the film, it kind of diverts, and it gets away from, like, that more... what I was expecting of a hunt story, of hunting down this creature and what they promised, at least to us, and kind of gave us as a story in that first maybe two acts of this three-act film. After that moment, we diverge more into that Weyland Yutani stuff, which, again, similar to you, is the weaker aspect to me of this movie, because I did like Thea. I like that inclusion within this film, and I think if they left it there, I'd been really happy with it. And I'm like, oh, it's more of like a nod to Weyland Yutani, and we acknowledge that they exist in this world somewhere, and they're not like an ever-standing, everlasting presence in this film. But then it shifts to very much Weyland Yutani versus Deck and versus Thea and Bud. And it kind of feels a little bit misguided. It turns into something that I don't think I was necessarily wanting to get out of this film, which maybe that's my expectations coloring a movie that I didn't know I was going to get and making me receive it in a way I probably would have otherwise if I knew what this film was more about. But you can see it in one of the, I think it was one of the Dolby or IMAX posters, you see in like the bottom part of the poster Deck going up against like a mega mechanical loader, similar to like what you see in Aliens that Ripley's in, but it's a more massive mechanical one, and it's like, I didn't think that that'd be this climactic fight for this movie. I don't know. It was just, I wanted more of that hunt. I enjoyed the aspects where it was more Deck figuring out this foreign land, trying to figure out how to survive. Everything on this land, this planet, is made to basically kill or harm you, and just having to kind of fumble his way through figuring it out. I enjoyed that aspect the most. I like the camaraderie between him and Thea, and then Bud as that sad, or that like added, like almost comedic relief to a degree. I liked it a lot, but it wasn't what I was hoping to get, and it is, to me, the most different from any Predator like franchise film that we've gotten so far. I loved Elle Fanning as Thea. I didn't love her, I forget, was it Tess or whatever?
Tessa.
I didn't love Tessa as kind of like a pseudo-villain of this film, but I really like Thea, and I like the camaraderie there. I think that the humor overall works pretty well for me. Just like, I remember like some humor in Predator, like, but it's more of like the, I ain't got time to bleed, like more of like the over-the-top cheesy stuff that plays for humor, where it's like not a lot of times where characters are setting out to make a joke. Whereas here, I'm like, we're starting to get characters making jokes. And it kind of doesn't fit with what I see a Predator film to be. And I think it is kind of just a difference in shifting to following a Predator. Like, you don't have Dutch. You don't have Naru from Prey. Like, it's interesting getting it from the Predator's viewpoint. I don't know if that makes it less kind of grisly or special to me. That, like, I think it is a little bit of a different type of movie compared to the rest of the franchise of what we've seen before, because the Predator is the hero, kind of, and we're rooting for him. Overall, I still really liked it. The action, for the most part, really landed. I think some of my gripes... actually, I love the score. Now it's to the gripes. I think there's a couple of action sequences where they're too quickly cut, and you'll lose a lot of the action. Not only that, there's a sword fight very early on between Deck and his older brother, shot in a very dark cave. And I'm like, what's happening here? Yeah, you have red-bladed swords or plasma swords or whatever. I can kind of see your swords moving, but like, I can't. I'm in a fucking movie theater in the dark and I can't tell what's going on. So there's some things where I'm like, it's shot interestingly where I'm like, I can't tell. Like, the choreography I'm sure is there, but I just, the way it's captured in screen, I can't really visualize this that well. And like, I like the CGI, I like the design of a lot of the creatures, but sometimes the action itself, I think, again, the editing of it kind of got hard. You could lose something in that edit. So I have some nitpicky issues. The third act doesn't really hold up the best for me. I still enjoyed overall the time I had. I liken this mostly to, like, of films I've seen this year of a franchise, like kind of like Tron Ares. But I like Tron Ares a lot more than this movie. But it kind of satisfies what I wanted out of Tron Ares. It does the same for the Predator franchise. It's not my favorite Predator film. It's my of the Trachtenberg films, it is my least favorite, but I still did have a good time.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's a kind of a weird one because I was entertained by it. I enjoyed watching it. But again, it just comes back to what franchise it's in.
Yeah.
Of being Predator and like feeling like it's getting a bit more quippy and fun, which I just didn't love that tone necessarily. Mm-hmm. I know they would never do it, but I would have loved if it was just the Predator in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And you just start the movie with him going to this planet, hunting a creature, and then bring it back. And there's no other like English-speaking roles.
Yeah.
I think that would be so cool. But obviously that's not a very accessible thing for people. Like, you need, for mainstream audiences, you need like human characters and Elle Fanning type to kind of balance it out a little bit. But I think just like seeing a Predator use his environment, kind of like Dutch did in the first movie, and doing that, just flipping it, I think would have been sweet. I do want to point out one other very random little thing that I thought was strange, which is the title reveal in this movie. It comes in at like the 20-minute mark, and it's after the Predator goes to the planet and he like kills the like tree thing or something, or he gets away.
Yeah, the branches thing,
And then the title pops up, Predator Badlands, which is fine. But it had like all of the credits around it, where it was like 20th Century Studio presents Predator Badlands, like this year. And I was like,
it felt very old school. And it didn't feel like, I liked it in the moment, but like, I'm like, I don't know if that fits, but okay. Like, it feels grand in the way it presents itself. But for this movie, I don't know if it, like, the movie lives up to the grand scale that the title tries to justify or implicate.
Yeah, like, I was fine with the title popping up, just all the text around it, I was like, interesting. Yeah. Not a positive or negative, but, I want to give a quick, well, I want to ask you first your ranking of the Predator movies, not including the AVP, just the core Predator stuff.
I haven't seen The Predator, the Shane Black film, but I've heard nothing but bad things. I maybe will watch it at some point just so I know for sure. So that's not going to be counted in my ranking. Least favorite? That's actually kind of hard. Because like I really like Predators from 2010 or 2011, the Robert Rodriguez-directed film. I like Predator Badlands. And Predator 2 is kind of like, it's not bad. It's fine. Predator 2 might, if we're looking at all the Predator films, be my least favorite. Then I'd say, right now, Predator Badlands, Predators, Predator Killer of Killers, Prey, and then the original Predator being my favorite. I think Prey is the closest we've gotten, though, like to achieving and replicating the success of that first film. I think Prey is fantastic. Like, if I could live in an alternate universe where Prey went to theaters and then Badlands went to Hulu, I think I would prefer that.
Yeah.
But obviously, I want them both in theaters, but if I could pick and choose which one had to go where, I would love to see Prey in theaters.
Absolutely. I have seen The Predator, unfortunately. It is kind of a special movie for me. It was the first movie I saw in theaters in college. So it was just like kind of that weird time where you're like, I don't know anybody and I kind of want to go do something. So I saw The Predator. And then I was like, wow, this is bad. This is a lot of bad. my ranking from first to worst would be Predator, Prey, Killer of Killers, Predators, Badlands, Predator 2, and then The Predator.
So we have the exact same ranking, aside from I just haven't seen the 2018 one.
So,
eye to eye on that.
Yeah.
But also, like, it's kind of for a franchise that has kind of come and gone and had so many kind of revamps and unsuccessful sequels, they're all kind of consistently at least good to me. Like, Predator 2 is still, like, I can watch Predator 2. You got Gary Busey in that.
Very interesting movie.
It's a wild take for a sequel to Predator. But I think it's really wildly consistent for how inconsistent of a release this franchise has had. And I feel like every time that they are bringing up a reboot of a Predator franchise movie, they're like, back to the drawing board. And it's like, well, the last one wasn't that bad. Like, I really like Predators. So it's an interesting franchise.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, sorry. I was just like muffling a burp. I stopped on a weird pause. Predator Badlands was kind of the big release, blockbuster-wise, I think, this past week. Another film, a little bit more of a quieter film that came out that I went and saw was Die My Love, directed by Lynn Ramsey. Lynn Ramsey isn't known for making, like, the most sunshine, happy, rainbows types films. Like, these are some really dour, depressing movies. She has directed We Need to Talk About Kevin, and You Were Never Really Here. Die My Love is her third feature directorial effort. This is starring Jennifer Lawrence and Robert Pattinson. Those are kind of the two heavy hitters. That's what the marketing for this film has relied on really in depth. The story follows Grace, played by Lawrence, who is a writer, now a young mother, who is slowly slipping into madness. And she's now locked away in a new to them, but an old house. out in Montana, and we see her kind of acting increasingly agitated and erratic, leaving her companion Jackson, played by Pattinson, increasingly worried and helpless. This is a I don't have a lot to say about this movie. I went in knowing that it was probably going to have somewhat of the effect that it did have on me. It's a massively serious, unflinching, well-directed, well-shot, perfectly acted, depressing as all hell, sometimes relatable, most of the time uncomfortable movies I've seen in a while. Lynn Ramsey makes movies that really stick with you, whether you want them to or not. We Need to Talk About Kevin is a amazing horror film. I never want to see it again in my life. I never want to watch that movie. I can remember scenes from that movie, and I know I never need to see it again. You Were Never Really Here, I love that movie. It is still very serious about really sad and depressing subject matter, and you have Joaquin Phoenix giving a really good performance in that film. I like that movie. Of Lynn Ramsey's works, that's the one I would like rewatch. And then you have Die My Love, which, like I said, it is relatable at times, especially being in a relationship. I'm married and talking about having kids, and this is a film about this couple that has their baby, and they're trying to figure out how their lives have changed since now having a baby. And it's a lot of conversations that I'm like, this is relatable. And like, I can think about how me and my wife would talk about this, or how this situation would work for me and my wife. And there's relatable aspects that sometimes are scary in how relatable they are. And sometimes I'm like, God, I hope that's not us. And sometimes I'm like, yeah, that's us. It's also, like I said, masterfully acted. Jennifer Lawrence gives, I wouldn't be surprised if she gets nominated for Best Actress this year at the Academy Awards. She gives a phenomenal performance. Robert Pattinson very much is in a supporting role. I don't know if I could say I liked watching this film. This film is well made, and it's good. Did I enjoy watching it? No. Not that that's a negative on the movie, it's just this movie doesn't lend itself to be an enjoyable watch. I could feel everyone in the theater watching this movie kind of just like shuffling in their seat, like, oh god. And it's 2 hours, it's really slowly paced. Not that it's boring, but it's very deliberate with the story it's telling and how it comes about. I would say my one negative is sometimes it shoots for kind of more surrealist, out there imagery. Doesn't always land, and I don't think it was necessarily 100% needed for the story it's telling. I think it's a bit too much. It's a bit pretentious at times, where I'm like, I think if you just left it at the bare-bones story, you leave all these out there surrealistic elements away from the story, I think you still have a really effective, good movie. And I think that the surrealist elements sometimes distract a little bit. Corey, I'd recommend this movie to you, but I also don't know if I'd ever recommend this movie to anyone. And that's a weird thing to say as someone who's like, this movie's good. Mm-hmm. Just a hard movie to be like, you should go see this, because it's not an enjoyable watch, but it's a good movie.
Yeah, I almost saw it this week. It's just, there's a lot of stuff coming out. There's just a lot of Oscar awards type things. So I may end up catching it in theaters. If not, we'll absolutely watch it, at home on streaming or something. But how was Nick Nolte in this movie? I saw he was in the cast.
Yeah, I forgot he was in this movie. Him and Tom Watts are also, not Tom Watts. Tom Watts was in the trailer for Father, Mother, Sister, Brother right before this movie. And I was like, oh, Tom Watts. And I keep confusing Nick Nolte and Tom Watts. Anyway. Nick Nolte in this movie, he has a small role. It's contained to a couple of scenes, but I was really surprised at how good he was. Not that I think he's a bad actor, it's just for me and Corey, Nick Nolte has become the punchline of a lot of jokes. So seeing him in a movie, and I'm like, oh no, he's like still a very accomplished actor, and he's still very capable. He gives a solid performance. He's not in the movie much, but his kind of impact from the scene he's introduced in throughout the rest of the movie, you can kind of feel him a little bit. He has a good supporting role. Not that I think like, oh, he's going to get nominated for Best Supporting Actor for his 5 minutes of screen time, because it's not like that, but I think he was really good. And he gave... Jennifer Lawrence plays a really complicated character. Through Nick Nolte, we get some of that softer, warmer side of Jennifer Lawrence's character, and I found that to be a really welcome part of the movie. And it was like they have some endearing chemistry, those two. It's not long, but I really enjoyed their interactions.
Right on. So this week, I took a little trip through film history and dipped my toes into the French New Wave era, which I will fully admit I don't have much exposure to at all.
This might be the extent of my exposure.
Yeah, I really don't know much about the history of it, but it was kind of fun this week to learn more about it and to just see some of the directors and hear about titles of movies that I've kind of been aware of and didn't know were necessarily part of this age of cinema. But I watched Breathless from 1960, and it's directed by Jean-Luc Godard. And the reason I watched it is because Nouvelle Vague is out in theaters now. It'll be on Netflix November 14th. It's the new Richard Linklater movie about the making of Breathless. So figured I would go through and watch this movie. And I had a good time with it. I enjoyed it. It's, again, we talk about it all the time of appreciating a movie but not necessarily loving it or wanting to rewatch it all the time. I think the most interesting thing for me was just the way that Jean-Luc Godard made this movie. There's a, if you watch it on HBO Max, there's a little intro to the movie with Alicia Malone from Turner Classic Movies.
I love Alicia Malone.
Yeah, oh, and yeah. she was on a lot of YouTube, like she was on The Collider.
She did Collider, and she worked with John Campion and Amy Rose Eisenbach.
Yeah, she was on Screen Junkies a bunch. Yeah. She's just like popped up on all these early kind of YouTube movie
very
review
nostalgic
stuff. Yeah, so seeing her pop up, and she gives like a little kind of backstory on the making of this movie, which was kind of the more interesting part to me. Because Godard just kind of, it was a run and gun filmmaking type of thing where it's just in the street. And kind of knowing that going into it, you can see so many extras in the movie that are like looking back at the camera or like the group of people filming. And like they weren't paid extras, they were just people on the street. So that was kind of fun to see. And just kind of having that background made the movie more enjoyable. It is a very like, there's a lot of like jump cuts in this movie. It's kind of jagged and choppy a little bit, but kind of to the movie, like I think it works for the movie. And it was kind of like a pioneering thing at the time where Godard was like, he had all this stuff shot and he's like, I don't want to delete any scenes necessarily. I just want to like trim down scenes. So kind of interesting. We see that all the time now. It's just done a little bit more efficiently. Yeah. So I enjoyed watching it. Jean-Paul Belmondo and Gene Seberg, two great leads in the movie. There's a, like, the whole middle section of the movie is just them talking in an apartment, and he's just incredibly horny the whole movie.
Yeah,
he's just like, hey, do you want to have sex? And she's like, I'm kind of like going through something right now. He's like, yeah, okay, but like, what do you think about that? Like, you want to move to like Paris with me or something? And it's, he's just a horn dog throughout the whole thing. So it was fun watching that one, and then I saw Nouvelle Vague in theaters, which this is a beautiful-looking black-and-white movie, and Richard Linklater, this is the first film of his that I've seen in theaters, so that was a fun little notch in my belt, too. And this movie stars, I don't know if I'm going to say this right, but Guillaume Marbeck and Zoe Deutsch, and it, like I said, it's about the making of this movie, so it really just follows the crew as they are shooting over this like 20-day stretch. And kind of the stress that they were putting on, like, the backers of this movie and the producers, because they're like, what the fuck are you doing here? Like, you need to film stuff. Some days, Jean-Luc Godard would be like, I'm tired and I don't really want to film, so we're just going to scrap a whole day of filming. And it was fun to just see that process. It is kind of inside baseball, where, like, this movie's not going to be for everybody. It's not, like, you know, I'm not going to recommend this one to people unless they are interested in the French New Wave era and how movies are made. I like movies about movies being made, so I enjoyed it. I think this movie is really well paced, though. I had a really fun time. Just it follows day to day of going through and gives more context to certain scenes about like how they set up the shots and why they did it that way, and kind of makes it more fun to see some of these iconic scenes from Breathless and why they are the way that they are. So I had a good time watching both of these. Again, just kind of a fun little trip to the French New Wave and learning more about that. I do kind of want to watch some more movies, like The 400 Blows, I've heard is pretty good, and just checking out some more of those and expanding my kind of film knowledge in that era, because it's an area I'm lacking in. So I like this. Mason, I would recommend Nouvelle Vague to you. Mm-hmm. I know you have seen Breathless, so I think that it would be kind of an interesting watch.
Yeah, Breathless is one that I feel like I'm always looking for, like, to clear off the movie bucket list, like hit all the heavy hitters, movies that are looked at as being greats or like masterpieces, and Breathless is always on that list. And I've seen it once. I've seen it also parceled out throughout a film course that I took, and I've always like, it's always the, I admire it, but I don't love it. Like, I see why it's good, but I don't have a connection to it. I do want to go back and revisit it, whether I do that before Nouvelle Vague or not. is kind of up in the air, but I am still really excited to see Nouvelle Vague. I don't know if I'll catch it in theaters, or I know it comes to Netflix here soon, so maybe I'll see it on Netflix, which I don't love to say, but the one thing that stood out to me when watching the trailer on the big screen was, holy shit, this looked, like, visually black and white looks fantastic. So I'm really excited to see that whenever I do get around to it. I kind of want to try and check it out in theaters just because I feel like the theater will kind of further solidify the great visual look of the movie.
Yeah, I saw it at the main theater, and they were doing a thing where they did like a double feature of Breathless and Nouvelle Vague.
That might not even be bad. Like, I saw that they were doing that, I was like, that might be a good idea to just really get into it, kind of steep myself in it the way that you watch both this week.
Because, when I bought my ticket for Nouvelle Vague, the guy was like, oh, did you see Breathless? And I'm like, I watched it at home the other day. He's like, oh, like, you get a free popcorn if you saw both movies, like, back to back. So, kind of a cool little double feature that they're doing there. And at the Main, it's always great seeing a movie.
The Main is one of my favorite theaters. The only negative I have is nothing about the theater. It's just that you have to street park, and it's so hard to find good street parking there. And you will be pressed for time because you'll park way down the street. And I'll be like, the showtime started 5 minutes ago. They do like 15 minutes though of trailers and ads, so I'm like, I can hoof it and get there in time. But I remember when I went to see 28 Years Later there, I was frantically looking for street parking. Yep. I couldn't find it, and I had to park like a block away, and then I sprinted to the theater. This is in like fucking what, June or whenever 28 Years Later came out, and I just get to the theater, sit down, and I am sweating through my jeans. Like, I am so hot and sweaty. And just in a piss poor mood watching a movie that I ended up really liking. But I do love the Main Cinema. It's one of my favorite movie theaters that we have in the cities here.
Absolutely. A movie that I caught up on this week that kind of sparked my attention because it got nominated for Best Feature and Original Screenplay at the Gotham Awards is Sorry Baby. Came out earlier this year. It's directed, written by, and starring Eva Victor. And you've also got Naomi Ackie, Lucas Hedges, and John Carroll Lynch in the movie. And essentially, this movie's told out of order. It's kind of different chapters of somebody's life, and it's kind of titled like the year that this thing happened. So the year with the bad thing, the year with the baby, the year with the really good sandwich. Those are all real titles, like kind of chapters of the movie. And it tells a story of Eva Victor's character and of Agnes, and it's, I don't want to reveal what it is because I didn't know going in, but something bad happened to her at a certain point. You don't see it until a later chapter in the movie, but it's
Do they allude to it, or do they make mention as to what it is? Like, because I've also been really interested in it, and I'm like, it's hard to keep myself from Googling what happened.
Don't.
Okay.
They make little nods to it, and it doesn't wait until like the end of the movie to tell you. Like, it is like the second or third chapter, I think it is. And then it kind of jumps around a little bit. And I think that it works for the movie to do it in a non-linear way because you get to see the before and the after in different times. It's kind of hard to talk about it without spoiling it. But I really like this movie. It does deal with a heavy kind of source material, but it doesn't feel daunting. It doesn't feel like a really like depressing movie. They deal with it in really funny ways. And even like the day after that this horrible thing happens, there's just some hilarious lines that are just so like kind of played straight, but are so funny. And I appreciate that because we have so many movies that have heavy source material and are also very heavy. And you just leave, you're like, okay. But this one actually deals with it in a good way. Eva Victor is great. I don't really know her from anything. I know she's been in like a couple movies and shows. Barry Jenkins, I think, was a producer on this movie, if I'm remembering that right. But it's really great. There's a final scene in the movie that is Eva Victor's character talking to a baby of her friend. And it's just like a very raw and very emotional moment. And just some really good advice for this baby that obviously can't understand, but just for the audience, obviously. It was just really kind of a touching movie at times, a very funny movie at times. Lucas Hedges is great. I love seeing him pop up in anything. John Carroll Lynch has an incredible scene that kind of plays into the sandwich chapter of the movie. It's just heartwarming. It's great. And I really enjoyed it. I think that this will kind of be in the, you know, got nominated for some Gotham Awards. I think it'll be Indie Spirit Awards, that sort of thing. So I would highly recommend this one. It's on HBO Max right now. That's kind of why I checked it out. So I know you almost watched it this week. Yeah. And I would definitely recommend it.
Yeah, it's one that I missed in theaters, I remember seeing the trailers of it, and I was like, I think this one might have some staying power in terms of, like, awards and the recognition for how, the quality of it. So, I know I've been wanting to watch it. I was going to try and watch it, especially since I saw you put it on the show notes, because sometimes, like, when I know you watch something one week, I'm like, I want to be able to talk with him about it, as opposed to having to, like, kind of be, like, interviewing you about the movie. But I'm super excited to watch it. I just made a decision this week to finish watching one thing and prioritize that over venturing into this film. Also, it's hard to watch movies with, like, really depressing subject matter, even if it is kind of like a lighter, higher spirit attempt or voyage into darker subject matter with my wife. So I'm like, I need to find a time when I can watch it separate from her, because I don't know how she would...
I think she could like it, actually.
You think she might be fine? Okay. Yeah. I'm like, it also, that's why I'm like, do I look up what it is that happens to this character so I can prepare my wife? Just because, like, she, if something bad happens to a person and it's directly because of someone just being bad, she just, my wife can't handle stuff like that. And I get that to a degree, but I'm also like, it's a movie, like, I need to just experience this. So I'm going to try and watch it this week for sure, and I'll probably report back to you guys next week on what I thought. But I'm really eager to sit down and watch this, and it being on HBO Max makes it all the easier. You and I both did a little Sam Raimi watch through of a new movie to both of us. Different movies, though. I did Drag Me to Hell. I'm still on my horror kick from post-Halloween fall time. So I watched Drag Me to Hell, which came out in 2009, which was directed by Sam Raimi. Talk about Spider-Man and Evil Dead all you want. Darkman, I didn't see until maybe like 2 years ago. Darkman's fucking awesome. I love that movie so much, so check that out if you haven't seen a lot of Sam Raimi's back catalog. And I'm really excited for, what is the new, the Send Help. I almost said No Escape. Send Help, that comes out later this year. Or is that this year or is that next year?
January.
It is January, yeah. Okay. Drag Me to Hell stars Alison Lohman, Justin Long, Lorna Raver, and Dilip Rowe. It's about an ambitious loan officer who must find a way to shatter this curse that threatens her soul with damnation. She refuses, like, an extension on a loan for a woman who is a gypsy witch and then curses her. And you get a lot of really tongue-in-cheek, pinnacle peak Sam Raimi horror. It's very, like, in your face. It's campy. It's very Evil Dead 2 in the approach it takes to things. It's not really a scary movie. It just has the horror backdrop, the horror setting. You do have some, like, visuals that are a little creepy and some decent, like, scares, but it is mostly the atmosphere and then Sam Raimi having fun doing whatever the fuck he wants with this story. I didn't love this movie. But I have seen, whenever, like, I always am like, I want to see horror movies that I haven't seen, and this one always is towards that top of the list, and I am a Sam Raimi fan. I really did have a good time with it. I think it has, which I wish I didn't know before seeing it, it has an awesome ending, and I wish I could have been exposed to this movie and see that ending for the first time without knowing what was going to happen, because I think I would have lost my shit. Even knowing that this ending was what I was eventually going to get out of this movie, it still works really well. Me and my wife have this running gag where Justin Long never wins. And he's also in a lot of horror movies. Similar how you do, like, a bunch of horror franchises, or you'll watch all the Texas Chainsaw Massacre over, like, in October. I think my wife and I next year are going to watch all the Justin Long horror movies. So, like, Weapons, Barbarian, Tusk, Jeepers Creepers. Probably rewatch Drag Me to Hell. But I thought that this was, like, a good, fun, nutty Sam Raimi romp. It was in your face. It's campy. Some moments or some aspects of the visual effects look cheap, but I think it only serves the movie in the positive aspect of, like, that feels like run-and-gun Sam Raimi, even though it's a more polished 2009 film where he's already an acclaimed director. It still feels like a dude just wanting to make a wild horror ride, and I really enjoyed this movie. It's not fantastic. It's not the best horror movie I've ever seen, but it is a really fun little nutty watch to watch around October. So I'm excited to rewatch it eventually, because I know I will. And it just further checks off, like, Sam Raimi, love what you do with Spider-Man. Darkman is kind of a superhero, quasi-superhero movie. You got Doctor Strange, Multiverse of Madness, good superhero movie. I want you to venture more into that weird, dark horror stuff, so hopefully Send Help kind of capitalizes on that as well.
I've owned Drag Me to Hell. I have the Blu-ray sitting out right here. I've had it for a few years now and just haven't seen it, so I think before Send Help, I'll definitely check that one out. But the Sam Raimi movie I watched this week, if you've been listening for a while, I've been doing, throughout this year, an alphabet watch-through, going through classic movies, started with A in January. I was on Q this week. Well, it's kind of whenever I have free time to watch a movie.
Chainsaw really fucked that up.
October kind of took up some time. So, finally got back to Q, and I decided to watch The Quick and the Dead. There's not a ton of options for Q, so there's the Queen and Slim in this. And that's about it. but this was in 1995, obviously directed by Sam Raimi.
You could watch Queer. You could have watched Queer.
I could have.
And I'm not trying to make a joke. I'm just actually really excited for when you watch that movie because I want to see what you think of it.
Anyway. I will watch it eventually for sure. But I'm glad I watched The Quick and the Dead because I remember you telling me you weren't a big fan of this movie.
This of Sam Raimi's stuff I think is maybe my least favorite movie I've seen.
Okay. I love this movie. I thought it was so much fun. It has, first of all, an incredible cast. You have Sharon Stone as the lead character, but you have Gene Hackman, Russell Crowe, Leo DiCaprio, Tobin Bell, Gary Sinise, Pat Hingle shows up, the old scary man from Home Alone is in this movie, Harley, I think his name is, with the shovel.
Yep.
He's actually a sweet man. He just wants to see his granddaughter, or daughter, his kid or whatever. Anyways, it's a really, really good cast in the movie, and essentially Sharon Stone plays a female gunfighter who goes to an old West town, and the whole movie is just a dueling tournament. And they just have a bracket up on the like bar, and they're just like, "All right, who's in the tournament? Mark everybody's names down." It's all the big heavy hitter actors. They're just like, "Gene Hackman in, Leo in, Sharon Stone in." And I'm like, "Yes." And I was a little worried at the beginning because I'm like, "Oh, interesting. I wonder if it's gonna feel stale after a while, just of kind of being these like shootouts in the town." But I think something Sam Raimi does well is make each fight feel very distinct because you have the classic iconography of the showdown that the OK Corral or whatever it is, where it's two people facing off, the wide shot of them, hand on the holster, waiting for the clock to hit noon or whatever. But each one feels very distinct, which is impressive. And I think Sam Raimi's style mixed with a Western just worked really well for me because he plays into all the tropes of walking into the saloon, the door swinging open, the spurs on the boots, you have the tumbleweed going by, the sunset, people riding on horses. He has all that in there, but then he mixes it with his weird zoom-ins and Dutch angles and then like crossfades of all the dueling tournaments going. And I was just really into it. And I thought it was just a really fun and well-paced movie. And you do get some backstory with Sharon Stone and her character and why she has a sort of connection to Gene Hackman's character. And I just really dug it. I thought it was a fun Western that played with the genre a bit, had a great filmmaker, just having a ball. It just seemed like everybody was having a good time on that movie. So I am very happy I watched this one. It was a good Q watch for sure, and it's kind of become a Western that I would definitely go back to now.
Yeah, I've only seen this once, and the cast is stacked. I remember thinking I didn't love Sharon Stone's performance in this movie, and I thought she was a little bit grating, but even just hearing you talk about it makes me like kind of excited and wanting to rewatch it. I'll probably check it out eventually, just because I'm a big Sam Raimi fan. And this is the biggest outlier, I feel like, from the rest of his filmography, where this, if you explain to me that Sam Raimi is going to be doing a Western film, that doesn't make sense to me. Like, Send Help makes sense to me. Spider-Man now makes sense. Like, this one feels like an outlier, kind of like an ugly stepchild, like no one talks about. And when you often look back at Sam Raimi's kind of filmography, this is one that I feel like doesn't get mentioned a whole lot either. So I'm hoping I'll likely end up checking it out again just because I'm a big Sam Raimi fan. And also just the premise is too good of just like bracket.
Perfect.
Let's all shoot each other in this town.
It's so simple.
Did Tobin Bell, was he Sharon Stone's dad?
Gary Sinise was the
Gary
dad.
Gary Sinise is the
Tobin
dad.
Tobin Bell is like one of the gunfighters
in the
tournament, yeah.
But you don't see Tobin Bell in a lot of things, like outside of Saw. So it's such a good cast, and I kind of want to go check it out again after hearing you talk about it. My wife and I checked out Zootopia, one, because she had never seen it, and two, because Zootopia 2 is coming out later on this month. This is directed by a massive team of Jared Bush, Byron Howard, and Rich Moore. I don't know if all three of them worked together, but I know, I think it was Byron Howard worked on Tangled, Encanto, and Bolt. It's Zootopia. Everyone knows what Zootopia is. It's about this city of all these animals and this rookie bunny cop and this fox trying to figure out a mystery as to why all these animals, all these predators, are likely going rabid and crazy and tearing up shit. So I really enjoy this movie. This is the third time I've seen it. It's still very fun. I think Jason Bateman as I think Nick the Fox or whatever the fox
Nick
is.
Nick Wilde.
Easily best casting like that. I see him and I can hear Jason Bateman. Like Jason Bateman has such a recognizable voice, and the entire voice cast is stacked in this film. I really had a great time. My wife really liked it. I don't have much new to add to this film that hasn't already been said, but it's just such a good, easy rewatch. And it handles a lot of serious adult material in a kid's movie, and it does it with a lot of nuance, which is kind of unexpected. And you get good references to The Godfather. You get, like, it's very noir filmmaking in a kid's animated film where there's all these anamorphic animals just trying to crack a detective story. So I really dug it. I still like watching it. It's kind of endlessly rewatchable. My wife was really confused by the whole nudist colony aspect when that happened. And I was like, yeah, I don't know what this is either. We'll just move past it. And she was also just caught off guard by how adult this movie is for being a kid's movie. Mm-hmm. But I'm like more so now excited to see Zootopia 2, where I didn't really ever need a sequel to that first film. But now, since we're getting close to that release date and having rewatched this, I'm like, yeah, I'd check out these characters again in theaters. So I'm pretty excited about that. You've seen Zootopia.
Yeah, the sloth part always kills
Flash.
Me.
Hell yeah.
Oh, it's incredible. Just I feel angry watching it. Just the slow, like, stamp or whatever he's doing
on
there.
It's also like them working out like the DMV, basically. Like, it's so perfect.
Yeah,
but
covers a lot of different themes, but I think it does it really well.
Yeah. Great movie. I'm excited for that sequel. I checked out Session 9, which I bought a number of weeks ago in preparation. I was going to try and watch it on Halloween, but I just didn't get around to it. So I finally sat down and watched Session 9 earlier this weekend. It's directed by Brad Anderson, who did the film The Call with Halle Berry from, like, 2016.
Oh, yeah.
He also, he's done some movies kind of sparseled out throughout his career, but he's more been like a prolific TV director. He's done episodes of The Wire and Boardwalk Empire and a number of other bigger shows. So I was just like, oh, interesting. He's kind of had an interesting career. This film stars David Caruso, Stephen Gavidin, and it's about this team, this cleaning crew that's going to remove asbestos from this abandoned mental hospital. And they start to encounter, like, through these tapes and through the walls of this really old, potentially haunted building, they're running into all this, like, horrific past that's, like, steeped within this building as they're trying to clean out the asbestos within a week so that they can get a good bonus paycheck. So it's a interesting kind of setting for a thriller. It almost works too perfectly. It's not outright terrifying, but there's some really good character drama and this film does a good job at keeping you an arm's length away when once the facade is dropped, it's like, oh no, duh. Like, of course this is what's going on. So I think that there's some really good scares. It's mostly the atmosphere of this film that really sells it and works for me. It was a really enjoyable watch. It's not overly scary, but there's some really good moments of tension. And the ending of this film, almost kind of like Late Night with the Devil, where he wakes up from that trance and he's at the end of his show saying, awake or asleep. I still don't know what the fucking mantra he says is. But that moment really, like, sticks with me and gives me goosebumps. There's a similar kind of aspect to that within this film. When a truth is unearthed and you see a character just kind of in the throes of it and realizing what's been happening and what's gone on. I think that this is a very quietly effective thriller that doesn't really widely get talked about, and I've only found it just because I was looking for horror thrillers that I haven't seen, and this one regularly got popped up and was in the conversation of that. So I checked this out. I was happy to watch it. It's a good enough time. It's not the longest movie. It's pretty well paced. So I think if you just need a good horror thriller to throw on, I think it's a satisfying in what it sets out to do, and it really is effective. So check it out. I think you'd probably like it a good amount too.
I've actually seen The Call, that Halle Berry.
You've seen
movie.
The Call? Okay.
Yeah, I remember getting that on Redbox twice.
Did you not finish it or
with,
what?
No, with my family. Like, I watched it with some members of my family, and then my mom was like, "We need to watch this again when, like, different family came over." And I remember
she really liked it.
I also liked it too.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. Maybe now it wouldn't hold up. It was like, I don't know, like 2013, 14, something like that. But I remember really digging that movie. I don't know. It's just like Halle Berry being a 911
operator.
Yeah. It was pretty good.
I mean, this is a really well directed movie. The only, like, misstep is there's some weird push-ins on actors. Mostly, there's one like specific shot that I can think of with David Caruso, who's in like all like the NCIS, like all that bullshit type of television. He has a moment where the camera flies in on him and he just says, "Fuck you." And it just feels so campy and out of place. And honestly, I think if I did have a negative, it might be his casting. His character that he's setting out to play really betrays what I know of him in other works. So it's kind of hard to get on board with it. And I feel like he kind of... some in scenes, he works. But overall, I'm like, I think a different actor might have fit this better. I think it's Peter Mullen that's in this really works. Josh Lucas is great. Most of the ensemble is really great. David Caruso, just like scene to scene, I'm like, I don't know. I don't know if you 100% work. But I still overall really did enjoy the movie and I'd recommend it. The big thing that I've been plugging away on and trying to watch through, and the reason why I didn't watch Sorry Baby this past week, is that I finally finished, literally 3 hours ago before I came over, Twin Peaks. I finished the first two original seasons, that original run of the show that came out in the late 80s. I finished Fire Walk With Me, and now I've since finished The Return. And... God, I have a lot to say. I don't want to turn this into a full Twin Peaks episode, so I'm going to try and keep it quick. I'm going to start with my negatives. My negatives with this show are really kind of one negative. And it's that the show is kind of tedious at points. Once you find out the mystery of who killed Laura Palmer, which was forced on the creatives by the studio because they're like, people are getting antsy, we need to reveal who the killer is. They reveal it almost midway through season two of that original run. Once you have that resolved, the back half of season two gets kind of tedious. It's kind of about nothing, but it's still like the characters you love, the world you love, the town you love. Twin Peaks is still great. It's just kind of campy and tedious, and it's like, what are we doing? We're just kind of spinning our wheels. And then in The Return, season three, the lead up to The Return, which the show is called, The Return of Dale Cooper, The Return to Twin Peaks, that can also get a bit tedious. There's some character stories with Dougie Jones and Mr. C that sometimes I'm like, I feel like we're just spinning our wheels. Where are we going with this? That's the extent of my negatives. This show has become one of the weirdest comfort watches I've ever had. One, because there's no atmosphere, there's no setting, there's no feeling or mood that is like Twin Peaks. Watching that, like, I've made it a habit of watching it in the mornings after I let my dog out. I'll have two cups of coffee and I'll watch two episodes of Twin Peaks. And it's been one of my favorite kind of rituals these past couple of months. Agent Dale Cooper, played by Kyle MacLachlan, is maybe my favorite fictional character ever made. He's so endearing, likable, honest, good at what he does. He works well with people. He's just a good guy, and he has some idiosyncratic behavior that is just so hilarious at times, where he's just like, he'll have a sip of black coffee. He's like, damn, fine coffee. Hot, too. And he just wants cherry pie and hot coffee all the time. And I'm just like, I relate to you for that. And he's just a great guy and a really solid lead for a show like this that gets so wacky, so out there, so scary at times. And this is a David Lynch brainchild. Him and Mark Frost created this. And you get a lot of that surrealist horror that David Lynch is known for and that dreamlike logic. There's things that just outright don't make sense to me. Even in The Return, I finished it 3 hours ago. So episode 17, which is the penultimate episode, the episode before the finale, I understood everything perfectly. It felt like the show wrapped up. I think I understood most things. Episode 18 happens, which plays out kind of like an epilogue. And I'm like, actually, I don't know what the fuck anything means anymore. I don't know what anything, like, what's going on here? So, and I like that. Sometimes I see movies or shows that don't give me enough answers to some of the questions they pose, and I'm like, you're just being lazy. Like, you're making me do all the work. You're not giving me enough. This isn't anything thoughtful. This is just you trying to be extra. Here, I'm like, David Lynch set out to do something, him and Mark Frost, and they achieved it. And while they had to take kind of a long way to get there just because of being forced to reveal who killed Laura Palmer, which in interviews since, David Lynch was like, I had no intention of ever revealing who killed Laura Palmer, which is funny because that's like what the main mystery is of those first two seasons. He's like, I wasn't going to tell you. We're just going to keep telling the fucking story, and it was just going to fall into the background. This show and the movie Fire Walk With Me is perfect. Like, if I was to condense this all into a viewing experience, it would be one of my 20 top 20 favorite viewing experiences of anything in my life. I remember watching True Detective, finally sitting down and watching through a lot of those seasons in 2018. I think when True Detective season 3 came out, that's when I went back and watched the first two, and then the third. And True Detective season 1 is one of my favorite. I count it as a film. It's in my top 20 of all time. Twin Peaks is the only other thing, television-wise, that rivals that for me. Performances, scares, fucking out there nutty shit that they won't explain, and I'm just gonna have to search Reddit threads to try and see what other people thought. This is a show that I'm immediately gonna buy the complete TV collection of, and I'm hoping to make a regular, either yearly or semi-annual rewatch, maybe twice a year. One, to hopefully understand it a little bit better, but two, to just further appreciate it, and three, just to have more time with these characters, just because this show is such a warm hug at times, and then it's also the most out there, psychedelic, upsetting shit you'll ever watch. And there's nothing like Twin Peaks. It's so well thought out, but also there's times where I'm like, I don't think anything is thought out. Everything's just so ethereal and out there, and it doesn't make sense, but it's so great. And this has further proved to me how much I love David Lynch, and has shown to me that he is maybe, if not my favorite, like maybe second favorite creative force ever behind Stanley Kubrick. Oh. I've now kind of developed this love of Twin Peaks in the way I did with the Dune films by Denis Villeneuve, where I then went out and bought all the original run books and started reading through those. I have since sadly found out that there are books of Twin Peaks, which I don't think I'm going to go back and read every single one of them, but I did order and will receive, I think, tomorrow. It's called the Twin Peaks The Final Dossier, which kind of unpacks some stuff and plot threads. So I'm going to read that, hopefully get a little bit of closure with some potentially remaining plot threads. But I was so excited to watch through this and so sad to finish it, because it is something so unlike anything else I've ever seen. And it's also something I don't think I could recommend to everyone. I don't even know if I could recommend it to you. There are episodes where I was just like, at the time watching it, pissed off. And then it would end and I'd be like, yeah, I like that, next episode. It's just like, it doesn't make sense. It just, this show like really infects you and is really fucking weird. And it's very different in different aspects of its release. Like the first two seasons is not a lot like The Return. The Return season that they did in 2017 is really dark, very violent, get a lot of nudity. It's more aggressive. Whereas, like, a lot of nudity, Corey goes, all right. The first two seasons is like a warm hug. Like, it's cozy. There's thrilling aspects, but it's cozy and weird and somewhat psychedelic. Return dives into it. So, I love this. I can't sing this show, this story, this property. I can't sing their praises enough. It's fantastic. I loved it. I can't wait to revisit it in any aspect. I kind of want to rewatch the pilot again, just because the pilot is one of the best TV pilots I've ever seen. But it's the closest to perfect it could be. And it's such a good watch.
I am very excited to watch it. I will absolutely watch it someday. It's one of those shows you always hear about. And just hearing your reviews every week of kind of chugging through it has motivated me to move it up my list of shows to watch. And there's just so many things to get through, but this one, I'm hearing like people talk about that, like, oh, I wish I could watch this again for the first time. When I hear 100%. that kind of motivates me more to watch something. A show that I checked out this week, you talked about great pilots for a show, I started watching Pluribus, which there are 2 episodes out right now. This is the new show from Vince Gilligan. He's the creator of Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul, and El Camino, that kind of trilogy of projects. He was also a writer on X-Files, which this show feels like it pulls a little bit more from. But much like you, where you said if you could combine everything of Twin Peaks into one, if I combine Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul, El Camino all into one thing, that's my favorite piece of media ever.
Oh!
Like, I like that more than any movie I've ever seen. I love both seasons of those shows, and I think El Camino is a perfect cap to that.
Yeah.
And so I love Vince Gilligan. I love the way that he builds out worlds and develops characters. I think it's brilliant. And he carries over Ray Seahorn from Better Call Saul, who is incredible as Kim Wexler. She is one of the standouts of that show. Every season you get to love her more and more. She deserved an Emmy. The show deserved an Emmy. I will always be mad about
that.
Did
it never get a nomination? Never
won. It got nominated for a ton, but it never won a single Emmy. Not even for any craft categories over all of its seasons. It is insane to me that show never won a sound editing award or some bullshit. Whatever, that's a different story. Pluribus came out this week on Apple TV+. Ray Seahorn's the lead. I don't even want to give away too much about it because I didn't know much going in. I hadn't seen a trailer. I just knew Vince Gilligan was the creative and knew that I was going to watch it. And the pilot is one of the most, like, I don't know. It was terrifying. It's not really like a horror, like, story at all, but it was really freaky. And there's so many visuals and imagery in that pilot that are terrifying in like a real world sense. If you were in that situation, how you would feel and how you would react. And I think it sets up this super interesting concept that kind of carries over into episode 2. And really, I have no clue where this is going, which is so refreshing because some projects here you're like, yeah, okay, I can see where we're going with this.
Yeah.
This one, I think, was really impressive the way that it started out. I like that Vince Gilligan is branching out from the Breaking Bad universe because I think that story is complete. I don't know that we need any more within that story. So I love the creative. I love Ray Seahorn. I love the concept. The pilot was awesome. I loved it. And I'm excited to watch it week to week. And I would recommend hopping on the bandwagon of this show early because I think it's going to become something like Severance, possibly, where people are like, oh, you need to watch it, and then people are going to get sick about hearing how they need to watch this show. So okay, Start watching it now so that you can be a part of it, because I think I get, like, I understand getting annoyed when people are like, you need to watch this thing, and normally because it's pretty good. But Vikings just get a fumble?
Recovery? I don't know. It's hard because the Vikings smashed it down and then someone jumped on top of it. But yeah, Vikings just started. So we're going to start rattling through things a little bit quicker here because I really want to see McCarthy play, hopefully well, this week. And we're playing the Ravens, which Lamar Jackson is the scariest man in the NFL. And they never give him his flowers. But I'm so happy he's back.
Yeah. Anyways, Pluribus, really cool. It's on Apple TV. They're putting out interesting stuff. I think they do a good job of having a wide range of shows on their platform. Yeah. So I would definitely recommend this one.
I feel like I didn't hear anything about this show until this week. I heard John Campia mention it, that the pilot came out, and there's been all these like big accolades, or not accolades, but everyone just kind of chirping about how good this intro is to the show and how out there it is. And obviously you have the creator of Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, and El Camino is so underrated. No one talks about that.
Yeah.
That movie is so good. I fucking love that movie. I might heed your kind of call to arms or your warning of, like, don't wait, start now, and I might have to jump in on this just because I'm hearing so much. And I was never at the front lines of Breaking Bad or Better Call Saul, and I love Breaking Bad. I only watched the first, I think, season and a half or two seasons of Better Call Saul, and I enjoyed it. I just failed to stick with it. So it might be nice to be on the front lines of a show and be able to be a part of that initial praise, as opposed to kind of, you mentioned it, the Severance talk of how everyone said it was so good, and I watched it, and I was like, yeah, it's good, but it's not great. So hopefully I'll kind of follow suit and get on board with that one pretty quick here. I did start It Welcome to Derry. It is Sunday. The third episode will be dropping tonight. This is the prequel series created by Jason Fuchs and Andy and Barbara Muschietti. Andy Muschietti, who is the director of It and It Chapter 2.
And The Flash.
really, just like diminishing returns on those movies. It is great, and then Chapter 2, and then
did
Flash.
Did he do Mama, I think?
He did, I think he did do Mama.
It's a pretty good movie.
And actually, Mama wasn't bad. That came out in like 2011 with Chastain, and I really actually dug that movie. It Welcome to Derry, the pilot episode, fucking thanks. Like, thank you, Andy. Thank you for being, like, this is going to be weird, but thank you for just killing kids. Like, thank you for not, like, you'll just go for it. And I really respect it. Sometimes it's a bit too much, but I really did respect how bold this pilot episode was. I didn't watch the second episode, even though it is available. My wife and I will likely watch that tonight. I really think it is a promising starting point for this show. The cast includes, I don't know how to pronounce his name, but he was in Overlord, I think. His name is Jovan Adepo. I love that man. Whenever he pops up, he's always great. And James Raymar is also in this. I love James Raymar. Ever since growing up watching Dexter, where he played, I think his name's Harry, Dexter's father and ghost of a father, I love James Raymore, so I'm excited to see him in this. So, Welcome to Derry. It's a promising start. I haven't watched all of the available episodes, but I'm really excited to kind of continue on with it and kind of prolong my spooky season with It Welcome to Derry.
This is definitely one I'll check out. It may be one where I wait until the full season's out and kind of watch through it, because I do like the story of it. I like the 2017 It a lot, so definitely going to check that one out. Coming out this week in theaters, we have a very kind of diverse release week.
Heavy release week, too.
A lot of big stuff. First one is The Running Man, the latest adaptation. We had a 1987 movie with Arnold, which I haven't seen, so I'm going to watch this week. I'm very excited to watch that one, actually. The story is based on a Richard Bachman book, which we've talked about Richard Bachman on this podcast before because it's Stephen King.
Yeah.
He wrote The Long Walk amongst, you know, all the other Stephen King books, but he just did it as a pseudonym for some books because, I don't know, whatever. sure, you know, creative people get weird sometimes, and writers, and Stephen King's coked
out. Stephen King's always been weird.
He's always coked out, so. The Running Man, this new adaptation, is directed by Edgar Wright, who is awesome. I fucking love him.
One of the most consistent directors ever.
Absolutely. And Glenn Powell stars in this movie. You have a great supporting cast, including Josh Brolin, Coleman Domingo, Michael Cera in the movie. And basically, a man joins a game show in which contestants are allowed to go anywhere in the world and are pursued by hunters trying to kill them. I love that concept. I'm excited, like I said, to watch that kind of 87 movie with Arnold. Watch this one. I think this is going to be a crowd-pleasing, kind of fun blockbuster.
Action romp, yeah.
Where everyone's like, yeah, you got a likable star in Glenn Powell, a fun, active director in Edgar Wright. I'm very pumped to check this one out in theaters. I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
Damn it, I was hoping you wouldn't throw it to me because I'm watching our offense move. But The Running Man, I'm really excited for. Edgar Wright, he's never missed for me. The World's End might be my favorite of his.
That's my favorite of his.
That is such an underrated. That might be his most underrated movie he's made.
Mm-hmm.
Last Night in Soho is a very special movie to me. It's the first movie me and my wife ever saw in theaters together. And I love Coleman Domingo. Honestly, like, yeah, he's not the main lead of this film, but anything Coleman Domingo in has a vote for me. Like, I want to go see it, and I've heard nothing but good things. And Edgar Wright is just such a good action director. I can't wait to see what he does here. Coming out, a director that doesn't always thrill me with the films he puts out, necessarily, but he is just pumping out horror films. Keeper comes out this year, or this week, directed by Osgood Perkins. He did The Black Coat's Daughter, which actually might be my favorite of his horror films, and it's also one of his more quiet-made films. I think A24 released that. He also did Gretel and Hansel, which I watched, Long Legs, and The Monkey. The Monkey I fucking hate. But this is a film starring Tatiana Maslany, Rusev Sutherland, and it's about a romantic anniversary trip to a secluded cabin that turns sinister when a dark presence reveals itself, forcing a couple to confront the property's haunting past. The trailers are the thing that have really sold this for me, and also Tatiana Maslany. I really do like her. Osgood Perkins is not necessarily hit or miss, but he doesn't reach my expectations. Ooh. For him. He doesn't...
Oh, JJ, nice pass. No. Nailer.
Oh,
nice.
Buddy! All right, sorry. I just that threw me off. I had to see Nailer. Nailer? Speedy is great. I love Nailer. Anyway, Keeper is the movie this week. Even after all that glazing of Running Man we just did, Keeper is the one I'm most excited for because it's a horror film, and it's from a director that has promising films. Long Legs actually really does work for me now upon a rewatch, and Black Coat's Daughter is really good. So I'm really sold on this. I'm excited by it. The trailers look fucking terrifying.
The marketing for Osgood Perkins movies are always great.
Yeah, I don't get why he has just the biggest marketing push for every horror film that comes out, but it's just... A lot of times, post that movie being released, I'm like, marketing campaign was better than the movie. So I'm hoping that this movie lives up to what the marketing is promising me.
Chris Stuckman has also been promoting the hell out of this movie. It's got some deal with
Neon. Yeah, where I'm like, you just got to, it's part of your contract. They gave you $1 million to reshoot some shit, and now you just got to glaze every movie that's coming out on their fucking docket.
Right.
So I get that, but I'm also like, stop it.
Yeah,
I'm excited. Every trailer has, like, Guillermo del Toro said this is the best horror. And I'm like, it just puts, like, a different director in it. I'm like, can we... Just show me the trailer. Like, I'll go see it. Like, it's fine. But I'm excited.
The other big release coming out this week is the amazingly titled Now You See Me, Now You Don't. Mason hates this franchise. Have you seen both of them? Or
I've seen half on FX, Now You See Me 2. But I remember seeing Now You See Me in theaters with my entire family. And, like, what, it was 2011? I don't remember when that movie came out. But I'm the youngest member of my family. And we came out of the theater, and we just scored a touchdown. Hell yeah. We came out of the theater and my entire family loved it. And I was like, that was maybe, I can't say that word, maybe the dumbest. Think of a word that would replace dumbest movie I've ever seen in my life. The straight up stupidest fucking thing. It's not stupid, the word that I'd replace. Ridiculous. Maybe keep with that letter. Just a... Yeah, Jesse Eisenberg should not be the lead of a franchise. And I like Jesse Eisenberg. How did we get a third one of these? How is this happening? Who said that they wanted another one? The fucking card trick that they do in Now You See Me 2 where the card like shimmies through the shirt sleeve, I think of Dave Franco, and down on the floor and somehow gets propelled across the... Oh my god. I was hoping like that they would either just like, yeah, it's magic, or they would say, oh no, this is how we're doing things, but they find a way to blur both and make it not make sense and make it really stupid. So I think that this is... I can't say that. This is the dumbest franchise to ever exist. Straight up. If I could delete any films from existence, these. There's worse movies that came out that have bad intentions behind them that you should delete. I'm still taking these out first. It's like the whole Michael Scott thing where he's like, if Hitler, Bin Laden, and Toby Flenderson are in the same room and I have two bullets, I'm shooting Toby twice. Meat of this trilogy. Mm. Fuck this movie. So stupid. Whoever created it, was it Ruben Fleischer? I don't know. He's directing this one. Did he do the first one?
This is his first time. I think, you know, I don't know if I would have had an answer for which franchise to delete, but this year, having watched the Toxic Avenger movies...
That too. Yeah, you can scrap that.
That one kind of...
Citizen Toxie didn't really seal the deal for
didn't,
you?
Didn't do it. Yeah, it kind of was dog shit. I've only seen the first movie, and I remember enjoying it enough. Thought it was fun. So I don't have the hatred for it.
This movie isn't worth the fucking, like, DVD inserts that get printed for it. Like... I would wipe my ass. I would happily, if I had expendable wealth, if I had all the money in the world, if I won the lottery tomorrow, if I got the Powerball last night, I'm buying every copy of this movie and burning it in front of the CEO of whatever studio mass produced this bullshit. Just to say, fuck you, this is ridiculous and stupid. And I know that there are fans who would be like, oh, this is a fun movie. Read a book, get smarter, don't watch this bullshit. Like, literally spend your time doing literally anything else. Watch football, grow up, do something else. Now You See Me should rot in hell. I don't know why I hate this franchise that much. I just do. It's just so stupid. Oh, my God. J. Kelly, also coming out in limited release. Have that to look forward to. It will be... It's one of those Netflix releases, Netflix originals that will go to Netflix in December, but we will have a limited release, hopefully at the main cinema for us. This is directed by Noah Baumbach, so immediately you have that accolade that's going to follow through with the director of The Squid and the Whale, While We Were Young, which is a really great movie that kind of snuck up on me with Ben Stiller, and Marriage Story, which is fantastic. You really like White Noise. Did you really like White Noise,
no,
or did you not like White
I
Noise?
I don't like White Noise.
I think I liked White Noise more than you. I forget, you had a really, I mean, not a, like... hot take on it, because I feel like the reception of White Noise was kind of like meh, but I remember when you watched it and you're like uh-uh.
Yeah, I saw it in theaters. I think it was also a Netflix thing, and I'm like, I don't
missed it.
Care
yeah.
for it. It just feels too heady and too fucking pretentious for me. Yeah.
But this is starring George Clooney, Adam Sandler, it's a famous movie actor, J. Kelly, which having George Clooney play this like almost quasi like famed movie star, almost like with like a 50s prolific career, like golden age Hollywood look to him, really is just perfect casting. But J. Kelly embarks on a journey of self-discovery, confronting his past, present, with his devoted manager Ron, who's played by Sandler. And I just, the thing that excites me the most is one, Noah Baumbach, but also Sandler in a dramatic mm-hmm. role. So I'm really, or a quasi semi-dramatic role at least. So I'm really excited for this. I can't wait to see it in theaters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Adam Sandler's getting some Oscar buzz, so I would love to see him get his first nomination. That would be great.
Yeah. What was the thing that he said? Was it the Spirit Awards where he, for Uncut Gems, where
yeah.
he was like, this is like the personality contest
yep.
in high school? I'm like, that's funny.
Yeah, he's great.
Yeah. Moving into a physical media roundup, looking at this past week, I bought randomly a lot of movies that I just really got excited about all at once. I heard about this thing called The Last Drive-In with Joe Bob Briggs, which is apparently something on Shudder where it's this man that sits down and talks about horror movies and kind of digs into them. But there's a Blu-ray release that is a double feature of Mayhem, starring Steven Yeun and I believe Samara Weaving. And also, it's a double feature with Suitable Flesh, which stars Heather Graham. These are both horror-esque films that I've been really interested in. And to see them kind of packaged in this like last drive-in double feature with Joe Bob Briggs doing some, hopefully some, like, cutting into the making of or some trivia about both films. I'm really excited about that, so I'm going to check that out here soon. I bought the Blu-ray of Cuckoo, which came out a couple years ago, that horror film. I actually really dug it. It had a scene in the film that actually scared me, and I think for that reason alone, I had to add it to my collection, just because it finally had, I had a shot that freaked me the fuck out, and I need that. And then I also bought In a Violent Nature, about the steelbook of that. I really, like, I enjoyed that movie. It's an interesting perspective of seeing it through the slasher. It's just really well shot, and there's some really good gruesome kills. And I had a good enough time watching it, so I'm really excited to add that to my collection as well.
This Tuesday, we got a lot of things coming out. Holy shit.
Yeah.
The Naked Gun 2025 is coming out, along with Caught Stealing, Together, Spinal Tap 2, The End Continues, Downton Abbey, The Grand Finale, Freakier Friday, Him, Eden, the 2025 version of Red Sonja, and then some older titles on 4K are The Mask, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and Spotlight. So lots of options for you. Together is the one I'm actually most excited to buy out of that kind of crop of movies there. Moving into movie news, we had some new trailers. A trailer that I did not watch, Five Nights at Freddy's 2. I actually am kind of excited for this movie. I enjoy the first one enough. I think it's a good little entry-level horror movie. It's fine. It's harmless, I guess. But then we had the Michael trailer, which was the much-discussed one. It was supposed to come out this year, delayed to next year. And it stars Michael Jackson's nephew, Jafar Jackson, in the lead role. Finally got to see kind of how all the prosthetics and the makeup and the movements, the dance, the singing, all that looked. And I know you're not excited for it. You don't like music biopics. I like Michael Jackson. I mean, who doesn't like his music? And Antoine Fuqua's directing the movie, so you've got some prestige behind the camera there. I'm excited for this one, but it's, you know, I don't know. I'm not like, holy shit, this changed my life.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not the biggest fan of the first Five Nights at Freddy's. I agree with you where it is like a good entry point for horror. If you're like new to horror, if I was a young kid and I saw Five Nights at Freddy's, I think that would help me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, really fall in love with that genre. So the trailer, you get Skeet Ulrich, Matthew Lillard. Like, I'm excited enough to go see this movie for a sequel for a franchise that I'm not the biggest fan of. But I'll definitely be checking it out because it's a horror movie going to theaters. You're right, I'm not super stoked about a Michael Jackson biopic. One, it's like, what are you going to focus on, his career or his personal life? And how are you not going to piss off someone by focusing on either or? The trailer looks like a Michael Jackson biopic. Cool. And you hear a lot of like classic Michael Jackson songs. I like a good amount of his music. I don't care to see a movie about his life, whether it is about his prolific career or his kind of sometimes shady personal life. I don't even really care as much to dig into that. I like his music. The trailer didn't sell me either way on it. I'm sure it's probably, of any musical biopic, going to sell boatloads of tickets and probably make a bunch of money. So maybe it'll be the highest earning musical biopic ever. Maybe there's that to look forward to. But other than that, I don't really care for either of these trailers or the properties that they're representing. We had an announcement from Toho. They unveiled just this past week that the next Godzilla film, Godzilla Minus Zero, or Minus 0.0. They revealed this at Tokyo Fest, Tokyo's Godzilla Fest, and it will be directed and written by Yamazaki Takashi, and the film continues the acclaimed Minus saga following the Oscar winner Godzilla Minus.
Godzilla!
Nah, I'm not gonna. That feels like I'm stepping into territory I shouldn't be. But I love Godzilla Minus One. It's probably my favorite Godzilla film ever made. The visual effects win was well deserved. It was such a refreshing take on Godzilla, and I really did enjoy seeing that in theaters. I can't wait to see wherever they go with this franchise. So I'm excited about this news. I'm not surprised by this news, but I can't wait for this sequel to eventually hit theaters.
Godzilla Minus One is definitely my favorite Godzilla movie, and I love the 2014 Gareth Edwards Godzilla.
Yeah, I like that one.
But I think Minus One has the best balance of the human characters and the Godzilla action you want in that movie, along with the Oscar-winning visual effects. They're awesome. Some very interesting news we got this week is that there's talks for a Mummy 4.
Woo!
With Brendan Fraser, or Fraser, however you say it, and Rachel Weisz returning. So I guess it kind of is ignoring Tomb of the Dragon Emperor, the third movie, because Rachel Weisz got recast in that movie or something. So I guess that one doesn't count. But then also, there's another Mummy movie with Lee Cronin directing it. Is that movie still happening, or is that...
That is, but I think it's completely removed.
It's just a reboot of this or something, but then we're getting both. I don't know.
I heard, which I saw a report that there are test screenings of that Lee Cronin movie and it's not playing well, which I don't know if that's like actually true or viable. Take that with a grain of salt, but maybe they're like, we'll just go back to what worked, actually. Yeah. That franchise that everyone loves still.
Yeah, maybe. So this fourth one is going to be directed by Radio Silence, who are Matt Bettinelli, Ulpin, and Tyler Gillett. They gave us the two latest Scream movies and Ready or Not, three movies that I really enjoy. So yeah. I have faith in them to put out a fun movie. Brendan Fraser, you know, at his big age, running around doing mummy stuff. You know,
they're gonna have to. Okay. Yeah, they're gonna have to make a story around kind of what works for them at their age and make it relatable. Because like in what the third one, Tomb of the Dragon Emperor, they have a child and like the son does a lot of like the big action, heavy lifting. So maybe they'll continue with an aspect of that. But having the duo behind like the Radio Silence duo, maybe I mean they revived Scream to a degree. So I wouldn't be surprised if they're able to do the same with the Mummy franchise. I love those Mummy movies. The first Mummy is so infinitely rewatchable. I love that. So I can't wait to see what they do with the fourth one. It's not something I'm like going to eagerly anticipate or put towards the top of my most anticipated list, but when it happens, when it comes out, I will be seeing it likely opening night. Warner Brothers also, in terms of announcing a continuation or bringing back a franchise that seemingly died a long time ago, they announced that they're going to bring back fucking Gremlins, because why not? They announced that Gremlins 3... will be released on November 19th, 2027, and with Steven Spielberg returning as an executive producer, Christopher Columbus will be writing and directing, and joining him are Final Destination Bloodlines filmmakers Zach Lipovsky and Adam B. Stein. It's the franchise's first film in 37 years. Maybe just let things stay dead, who knows? But it's also interesting to have this information paired with the Mummy 4 information of we're going to bring this franchise back. We're going to have some of the main creatives come back, but we're also going to pair them with a duo of directors that have revived a horror franchise, where we had Radio Silence with Scream, now we have the duo behind Final Destination Bloodlines, which is my favorite Final Destination movie, have them help kind of bring Gremlins into the modern era. I don't need this. If they really feel like they have a good enough story to warrant making this, then fine, I'll go check it out. I love the original Gremlins. I don't know if I've seen Gremlins 2. It's been a while since I've seen the first one. I feel like I might like mix aspects of it up. I don't know. But what I remember seeing, I like. I don't know if I need a third one, but fuck it. Why not? Just keep them going, I guess.
Yeah, I've seen like bits and pieces of, I think, the first and second one, but I don't know that I've actually like fully watched through either of them. So
the first one's a good Christmas movie. I will say that. Maybe watch that for Christmas this year, or around Christmas.
Maybe I'll do that. I like the poster for Gremlins 2, the new batch, with the Gremlins smoking a cigar, sitting in a chair. That's really cool. I don't know. This could be okay. So Paramount, a lot of news about Paramount lately, but they said that their new Star Trek movie is going to be a reboot. It's not going to be a continuation of the kind of Kelvin timeline, the J.J. Abrams three movies that he did, with Star Trek 2009, Into Darkness, and then Star Trek Beyond. I like all three of those movies. I thought it did a great mix of the kind of heady Star Trek stuff from the early movies and then combining it with like modern sci-fi action blockbuster kind of.
Yeah, bringing in new audiences to Star Trek. Yeah,
absolutely. I think it's a bit more accessible for people to get in while still paying homage and respecting the previous movies. I love the cast of those ones. I love Chris Pine, Zachary Quinto, and Zoe Saldana in those movies. And I'm kind of sad we only got three movies with them.
Yeah.
I think it could have been at least like four or five. Like a five-movie run with those characters would have been great. So kind of sad, but also, you know, I haven't seen a lot of the original Star Trek movies, so I guess this will give me a chance to kind of watch through those original ones. I've seen the first, like, three, I think. And then I haven't seen any of the Picard movies, actually. So, excited to watch those whenever a new movie is kind of on the release docket, but sad that we don't get the kind of J.J. Abrams universe that he created.
Yeah, and I feel like a fourth one was in the conversations for so long for it now to be dead, so I'm also sad with you. I really like the three that they put out, especially Star Trek Beyond. That one's a little bit more underrated, I feel like, than the rest of the other two. But they're great films, and I really wish we could have stuck around with this cast a little bit longer. AMC Theaters has reported a steep $298 million third quarter loss compared to the $20.7 million a year earlier, with revenues dipping to $1.3 billion. This decline stems from a weaker box office turnout and higher refinancing costs and fewer major film releases. At least that kind of plays into what CEO Adam Aron has cited as shifting release schedules and a post-strike content slowdown as the major factors. But he's predicting a strong holiday rebound and revealed early talks with Netflix on potential theatrical collaborations. I like the idea of that last part, that literal last part of maybe we'll work out something with Netflix and put more movies in theaters. I like that. Good job, Adam Aron. It's the only time I'll ever say that. I'm not surprised. It's kind of sad. Not only, like, AMC is one of the biggest theater chains, if not the biggest theater chain in the United States. To see them faltering, one, I hate Adam Aron, and I'm like, you know what? You're kind of killing the theater business. But it's more of just, like, put your finger on the pulse. Like, theaters are dying. They need people to go see movies and support the theater industry. And it's not always the easiest thing to tell people to go do, especially if we are kind of in a dry spell of releases, which I don't necessarily think we are. There's movies there to go see and interesting things to go check out if you really want to go see a movie in theaters. But do people want to do the theater-going experience? Do people want to pay the money for it? Ticket prices are rising. You got concession prices rising, which, to me, I'm like, if you could find a way to not have to get a ticket and only pay for concessions, do that. Support the theaters. You don't necessarily need to always support a lot of these bigger movies, in my mind. I used to, when I would work, I worked at a movie theater for a long time, and when I would buy tickets for the smaller film and then go see an Avengers type or a Star Wars type, a movie that didn't need my money. But regardless, the theater industry is suffering. Adam Aron, I still fucking hate you, but I don't love to see that AMC is suffering so badly. Not that I think you're not to blame for at least an aspect of that or a part of that. So the theater industry as a whole is really hurting. Streaming, theaters, whether it goes to theaters or not, whether it goes straight to streaming, I feel like that's a conversation we're going to be having for at least 5 more years. I feel like theaters are just, it's a place where everyone can be the same and go experience something special and see it with a group of people that are excited about the same thing. Hopefully. But it's sad to report that AMC is really struggling as much as they are this past quarter.
It was a rough October for the box office.
That too.
For
it
sure.
Was, what, one of the worst in 30 years?
Yeah, in a long time. So I'm hoping that the rest of this year with maybe Wicked, Zootopia, Avatar, we can rebound a little
Kick
bit.
Kick it up a lot, yeah.
I think one thing kind of locally here at least is the Imagine Theaters. Smartly what they've done is, I don't know if you've been to the Imagine Egan lately, but they added a whole arcade to the left side right when you walk in. They also have axe throwing. They have a bar. They have a bunch of, like, good food, actually. Like, pizzas and all kinds of, like, more stuff than just popcorn and all that. So I think that's what theaters need to do to, like, draw people in. People are doing axe throwing. They're like, oh, let's go see a movie afterwards.
Yeah.
So kind of having other things within the same building, or like an arcade for kids to go play at and be like, oh, let's go see the new MCU movie or whatever it is.
Build out a bigger experience outside of just movie going.
Yeah.
And find a way to get people in. I kind of agree with that.
Yeah.
Like the Imagine Theaters, which are mostly in the Midwest, we're lucky to have a number of them in Minnesota. Mm. I love them. It's my favorite theater chain. AMC, maybe learn from some of the smaller guys, some of the smaller theater chains.
And Imagine is consistently like 15 minutes.
And they do a good job of alerting you to that, too.
They have like 4 trailers that play, a couple ads, and that's it. Gets into the movie. So I think they have a good system going. I think they need to keep that up for sure if they want the theaters to stay alive here. Some news from the DCU. We have some news on Lanterns, the show the showrunner, Chris Mundy, the show starring Aaron Pierre and Kyle Chandler as two lanterns investigating a mystery on Earth. And it was originally going to come out before Supergirl, but now it's going to come out in the second half of 2026. I'm really excited for this. Mm-hmm. I've only really seen the Ryan Reynolds Green Lantern. That's kind of my exposure to the character of Green Lantern. So those two actors in this kind of True Detective-esque mystery that they've teased is really interesting to me. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious to see, you know, if it plays into the ending of Peacemaker Season 2, if it touches on any of that stuff with, what's the fucking world, the prison that they put Peacemaker on?
Salvation? Is it Salvation?
Something like that. Yeah, I don't know. I've heard teases that it would play into that. I'm not 100% sure. But I'm excited for this one, for sure.
Yeah, I'm stoked just because this feels like the most out there. Like, one, we don't have a lot of Green Lantern properties in general. You referenced the Ryan Reynolds movie, which is not great. So we don't have a lot of voyages out into this, like, character's world. Also, the way that they're kind of marketing this and the way that they're talking about the show of that True Detective-esque story of these Green Lanterns, and we really only have that one photo of Aaron Pierre and Kyle Chandler walking down that road, mm-hmm. and it's just like, this doesn't feel like a marketing image for a superhero show, so I'm like, yeah. I'm really intrigued by that. Regardless of when it comes out, I'm excited to see it. I can't wait to watch it and see how it further builds out the DCU. I'm most excited about what kind of tone it sets and how it differs from what we've gotten with Peacemaker and Superman mm-hmm. and Creature Commandos so far. So I'm excited for that whenever we get it. And we also got a bunch of Grammy nominations for the 2026 Grammys. In terms of how they relate back to movies, for nominees for Best Compilation Soundtrack for Visual Media, we have nominees for A Complete Unknown, F1, K-Pop Demon Hunters, Sinners, and Wicked. Best Score Soundtrack for Visual Media, we have How to Train Your Dragon, Severance Season 2, Sinners, Wicked, and The Wild Robot. Interesting to see Severance in there. Best Song Written for Visual Media, As Alive As You Need Me to Be, which is from Tron Ares.
Good song.
I love that song. Yeah, I've been listening to that a lot. Obviously, you have Golden from K-Pop Demon Hunters, I Lie to You from Sinners, Never Too Late from Elton John, Never Too Late, which didn't that get an Oscar mm-hmm. nominee? It's kind yeah. of interesting how like the schedules of these award shows line up and yeah. we're talking about things. We've got Pale Pale Moon from the Sinners and Sinners from Sinners. So I think Sinners had it tied a record for the most amount of Grammy nominations for a film in history. Or it's up there in terms of the number of nominees mm-hmm. that it's received. I love that movie. It's fantastic. I'm not surprised by the K-Pop Demon Hunters nominations, and also I'm not surprised by the Wicked nominees. I'm not surprised by really any of these nominees, except for the Severance Season 2. I'm like, okay, nice to see some recognition for that. Yeah. So I'm pretty stoked about this. Are there any kind of nominations that really stick out to you, Corey?
I think with the compilation soundtrack, for everything except A Complete Unknown, it was like various people nominated. Mm-hmm. But A Complete Unknown, it was just Timothy Chalamet. So it could be the beginning of an EGOT run. If he does win this, you know, this would be kind of the first of that. So something to keep an eye on in years to come. He'll get an Oscar someday, whether it's for Marty Supreme or for something else down the line. So
maybe Doom Part 3, Doom Messiah.
Doom Messiah, could be. Yeah, so also Kendrick stays winning, got the most nominations, got 9 for Luther. You know, he got GNX, got some noms too, and some other collabs with SZA, so... Kendrick's just a dog.
My yeah. wife was like, Sabrina Carpenter got 6 nominations. I was like, how many did Kendrick get? And she's yeah. like, shut up. I'm like, okay.
yeah, he's a dog.
He's the best. Anyways, football's on. We need to get through this and watch that. So thanks for joining us for another episode of Slate Night, the Film Fan Podcast. Follow us on Instagram and TikTok for more in-depth movie reviews and movie news. And don't forget to subscribe, whether it's to our Instagram, to Apple Podcasts, to wherever the fuck you're watching us. Please subscribe. We'd appreciate it. In the world of film, it's not just about what's on screen. It's about who's next to you in the theater.
For Mason and I, it's Late Night. That's a wrap.